The Hallie Kesser Jane Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, available online at HallieKesserJane.com. The Hallie Kesser Jane Show is supported by the following. Welcome to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. I am Hallie Kesser Jane. Let's talk. Today on the Hallie Kesser Jane Show, the man sometimes referred to as the King of Bubblegum Rock, singer, songwriter, Tommy Roe. Tommy Roe recorded six top 10 hits between 1962 and 1969, more than any single artist, songwriter during the period of the 60s. Tommy has four gold records, and two of his hits, Sheila and Dizzy, topped the Billboard chart at number one. With a total of 11 records reaching the Billboard Top 40 and 23 Billboard Top 100 chart records, Roe is one of the early pioneers of the American pop music culture. Now, out with a new biography, and what a read it is, with intros by record mogul Scott Borchetta, Wink Martindale, and Republican pollster Frank Luntz. What? Well, we'll have to ask him about that. From Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and places in between is raw, candid, funny, sad, an encyclopedia of music history. Now 74, Tommy Roe is far more than the music that still brings crowds when he performs. His is a voice that stands for a generation. But before we begin, The Hallie Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com. Okay, Mr. Roe. Time flies when you're having a good time. You seem to be having a very good time. You must be doing something right. I was looking at you on all sorts of places, and darling, you're looking marvelous. Handsome as the day is long, buddy. What's the deal? You really do look very young.
Is in the business, you know, I'll be 75 years old in next May. Oh. And for that age, I feel like I'm 50 years old. I mean, I feel really, really good. You know, I don't, age, I guess, is just a number.
So. Well, ladies, I shouldn't do this, but he looks great. He looks great. Go online and look him up. He looks fantastic. You feel good now, right? Am I buttering you up enough?
Yeah, that always makes me feel good. Compliments like that are always welcome.
All right, I'm going for it. So listen, Tommy, I want to talk about a whole lot of stuff with you, but one thing that I want to start with is this new biography you've got out, From Cabbage Town to Tinseltown. Mm-hmm. I love it. Cabbage Town, I know what it is now. Tell the audience what Cabbage Town is and why you got the title.
Well, Cabbage Town is a section in Atlanta, kind of just outside the city, and I lived there off and on. My aunt used to live there, and she used to work in the Fulton Bag Cotton Mill. It was a working class neighborhood, and it was called Cabbage Town because mostly, you know, Northern Europeans or people from Appalachia moved in to work there in the mill, and one of their staples was cabbage. So if you walk through the streets of Cabbage Town in the afternoon, you would surely get a scent of cabbage coming from every kitchen in the neighborhood. So they call it Cabbage Town. And I lived there till I was about 6 years old, and then we moved not far from there to the West End, and I actually grew up in West End, just outside of Atlanta.
You don't sound like you're from Atlanta.
Well, I'm in California right now, and I've lived in California for a long time. I've always kept my home in Georgia, you know, but I moved here in 1965. I was living in New York at the time, and I was just out of the Army. And I got a call from my manager, and he said, listen, Dick Clark's doing a new show in California, and he wants you to be a regular on that show. It's called Where the Action Is. So would you consider going out there? So I called Dick, spoke with Dick. He said, look, Tommy, come on out. It'll be fun. You'll only be here for about 6 months. We'll do all the taping, and you can go back to New York. I went for the 6 months, and I'm still here. I mean, I never left.
But you left your accent back in Georgia, because, honey, you don't sound like you're from Georgia at all.
Well, it's gone, baby, gone. Yeah, it comes out a little bit when I go back there, you know, so it's there. It's lurking underneath.
It's lurking underneath, or when you get angry, right? That's when it really comes out. So listen, this struck me so funny, because, I mean, I started to read the book, and everybody should read this book for a lot of reasons, which we'll discuss as we go along. But one of the things that was interesting to me was that you've got people writing the foreword to this book. You got the great Scott Borchetta. You got Wink Martindale. Oh, my God. And Frank Luntz.
Yeah. It's a combination, isn't it?
Well, there's where did that one come from? That was great. And let me tell everybody who Frank Luntz is. He's the Republican pollster. Terrific guy. Knows his stuff. Are you friends?
Oh, I'm very close friends with Frank. Frank throws a party every year for the military, for the vets, you know. Uh-huh. And he has a beautiful home here in California. And he sets up a stage on his tennis courts. And we do a show there for the vets every year. So that's how I originally met him. He was asking a friend of mine, Michael Lloyd, who lives here, to get some guys to come and sing for his party. And they asked me to do it. That's about 5 years ago. And I've done it every year for 5 years now. So great guy. And he loves 60s music. I mean, he is a huge fan. And his favorite Tommy Rowe song is Hooray for Hazel. And every time I see him, I say, I still don't know why Hazel is your favorite. Please explain to me. And he really doesn't have an answer for me. He just says, I just love the song. It makes me feel good. So I don't know.
So we're jumping ahead. And for those who don't know this song, this is one of your great songs. And it was based on the television show Hazel. Am I right about that? Yes,
that's correct. It was one of my favorite sitcoms. And I was sitting watching the show one evening. And I said, you know, I write songs about girls. I use a girl's name in my titles. Why don't I write one about Hazel? So that's what happened. I started banging around on the guitar, watching the show. And that's what came out.
And Franklin love that. I mean, right? That's just hilarious.
Yeah, I mean,
but that is not your favorite song, the way you just said that, though, to Frank Luntz. That's not your favorite.
Well, no, I love it. I love all of my songs. They're fun. They're all fun to do. And, you know, each one is a little different take on things. But usually people say Dizzy, you know, that's my favorite Tommy Rowe song, or Sheila, or Sweet Pea. Very seldom do I get people, you know, calling out Hazel. But I'll tell you a funny story. I was in Tennessee a couple of years ago. We were doing a show for a bikers convention, and they were actually Christian bikers, you know, so they weren't, they wore all the garb, you know, the black leather and
right.
studs and all that, but they were Christian bikers. And so I started doing my show, and this guy came up, he kept coming up to the stage asking for Leather Honey. And I said, Leather Honey, you mean my song Heather Honey, don't you? He said, no, with our babes, it's Leather Honey around here. So you never know what's going to happen with one of my tunes. I mean, these guys loved Heather Honey. And as I was singing it, they were singing, oh, Leather Honey, warm as sunshine, singing right along with me. I mean, it's terrific, you know.
It's extraordinary.
Every time I play for bikers, I change the title and just sing Leather instead of Heather.
Oh, I think that's hysterical. You ought to come down here where I am. There's big bikers. Maybe one of the most famous biker bars in the world is right here in Florida where I hold up. Listen to me. This is interesting because you really did come from a musical family. Everybody played, right? Isn't that how you learned?
Well, my grandfather played banjo and a little bit of fiddle, and my dad played guitar, and that's how, you know, he taught me to play the guitar, of course. And so I grew up sitting on my grandparents' front porch on the weekends. We would visit, and that wasn't too far from Cabbage Town. And every Saturday and Sunday, we would go, to church, and we'd come in on Sunday and would be on the front porch playing music. And I mean, I just grew up with that. That's the way it was in our family. And most everybody in my family, the dad's brothers and sisters, they all played something. And it was quite a hoot, you know. And
let's talk about the way that you started, because I love your story. I like stories like this. I like stories about guys who start off very young, start fooling around, and then the next thing they know, they're on top of the world. I want to explore how you got there. You're a kid in this little backwoods kind of town in Georgia, and your family's playing music, and I assume that you're listening to the radio station a lot. Yes?
Oh, constantly. That was my every night, late at night. I would my mom bought me a silver tone record player and radio player, and it used to be right next to my bed. And you couldn't really hear rock and roll or rhythm and blues during the daytime. They'd play Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Kate Smith, all that stuff. But late at night in Atlanta, there was a station, WAOK, and they played blues music. And I used to stay up all night listening to this station. About 10 o'clock they started. And mother always was wondering why I couldn't get up and go to school the next morning. I wouldn't dare tell her it was the radio. She'd have taken it away. But I used to love to listen to that rhythm blues, Jimmy Reed, John Lee Hooker, and all of those old
Muddy
Waters, of course, and James Brown. And then Hank Ballard was a big hit in Atlanta when I was a kid. I mean, you know, he wrote The Twist, but he used to do shows around Atlanta all the time, and I'd go see him perform and everything. So, yeah, I was into music at an early age, and I was very fortunate I got lucky in a lot of ways at a young age to be able to be successful at 20 years old, have a number one record at 20 years old. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Daunting, I'm sure, and we're going to talk about that too. But I want to ask you, did you set out, though, to be a musician, to be able to play, or to be a star?
You know, I know in the beginning with me, I used to write these poems, and I tell the story about writing the poem about Frida, which turned into my first hit, Sheila. But I would write these little poems, and they were, you know, they certainly weren't Shakespeare. But then my dad taught me three chords on the guitar, and I thought, and I was a shy kid, so I never dreamed I'd be on stage performing. So I thought I would be a songwriter, you know, and write songs for other people. I love songwriters, singer-songwriters especially. And so it just kind of happened, you know. Once I learned the guitar, the three chords is all I needed, you know, to write a song. So I started writing songs, and I couldn't get anybody to record my songs. So I said, well, maybe I'll record them myself. And I put a little band together in high school. We had a band, and Bobby West on guitar and Mike Clark on drums, and I had a bass player named Drolle Bush. And Drolle and I still see each other to this day, and we would play around. We played fraternity parties, and we played after the basketball game at the high school, and wherever they'd let us play, we played, basically, you know. But that's kind of how I got started, and just one thing led to another.
So question here also about that, because I think that not a whole lot of people get where you got in music. Let's you know, what's the percentage, like, you know, one billionth of whatever.
At such an early age.
Yeah, and such an early age.
And I wrote Sheila when I was 14, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And at a time when music was so phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know that we can say that today, with all due respect, but that was really that was the foundation of everything we are today. And there you are at the top of your game. I want to talk about Felton Jarvis, but he was a friend. It was before he actually really made it that you guys connected. Am I right?
Yeah, I met Felton. He worked in a printing office behind the studio where I was recording while I was in high school. It was an old schoolhouse. And I met Felton. He used to come peer into the studio through the glass all the time. He was a printer. He worked in the print shop. And so that's how I met him. And then he connected real good with Ray Stevens. Ray Stevens was there in the studio working with Bill Lowry. And they became very close friends. They actually, they married sisters, you know. Felton married Ray's wife's sister. So they were very close family. And so I hooked up with Felton. I was doing a show for a DJ in Atlanta, and the DJ invited Felton to come see me perform. And that's when I first hooked up with Felton as far as making music. By that time, he had already made some records and was producing some records with Ray. So he was kind of in the business, you know. So Felton wanted to do something with me, and he wanted to make a deal to go to Nashville and do a session. So he was the one that put it all together for the first hit.
Now tell everybody who he turned out to be.
Well, Felton, when he was in the Marines, he used to love to tell this story. He used to, in the officers club, he would pantomime Elvis records and mimic Elvis on stage. He was a huge Elvis fan. He was a fanatic, really. So all he would talk about was Elvis Presley. And I told people, and back then I said, you know, the only reason Felton wants to be in the music business is to meet Elvis. I mean, he's such a fanatic. And sure enough, after he recorded Sheila with me and everybody, my follow-up was a hit, he moved to Nashville and got a gig with Chet Atkins. And he ended up marrying Chet Atkins' secretary, Mary. And Mary was Elvis's original fan club president. So he was gaining on it. He was getting close.
Unbelievable.
To Elvis. So finally he meets Elvis, and Felton was the kind of guy that you fell in love with. He was just a super guy, a fun guy. You'd love to be around him because it was always a laugh and a good time. So Elvis meets Felton and falls in love with him, like all of us did, and hires Felton to produce his records. And so Felton worked with Elvis the last 10 years before Elvis passed away. He was in the Memphis Mafia, and that was his whole objective from the beginning, and I think he made it, you know.
It's unbelievable, but see, this whole thing, I'm reading your story and all the people who were around you, and I'm saying, you know, this was like the gods at work here, because everything is intertwined. I mean, it's a phenomenal story. It really is. So you go to Nashville, you go into the studio, You then you get Elvis's backup band, the Jordanaires, behind you when you re-record this new version of Sheila, right? Am I telling this right?
Well, yeah, I re-record Sheila. I'd recorded I was in high school, you know, and it was like a local hit, but never did anything. And Felton said, we're gonna re-record Sheila, and we're gonna put some Buddy Holly drums in it. And I didn't like that idea because I didn't like the idea of pinching Buddy Holly style, you know, but Felton insisted on doing that, and it worked, because I think that was really what helped make the record a hit, was the rearranging that he helped produce. But yeah, we go into RCA Studios, the little studio there that's now the museum, you know, and they're telling me that I will be singing on Elvis Presley's microphone. Well, I was already nervous, you know, so when they told me that, I was really shaking in my boots. And then they said the Jordanaires will be singing backup. Well, you know, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was like a 20-year-old kid. Actually, when I recorded Sheila, I was 19. And here I am in the same studio where Elvis recorded, and the Jordanaires are backing me up, and Elvis's band guys are backing me up. Jerry Reed's playing guitar, Floyd Kramer's on keyboards, and Buddy Harmon on drums, Bob Moore on bass. I mean, they were all stars, you know, and I was amazed. And the funny thing about the session, it was what they called back then a split session, where a producer would take two artists and they'd book a 3-hour session and they record two different artists in one session. So you would end up with maybe an hour and a half to do your recording. But what happened, they recorded Marvin Benneville, who used the name Vince Everett for his record. And they did him first, and he took 2.5 hours, you know, and I was left with 30 minutes to do my two songs. And so we did what we thought was the A side first, Save Your Kisses. And I was left with about 5 minutes to record Sheila, and we ran it through and cut it. And that was the record. I mean, that
really?
Was
it one take kind of thing?
One take. I mean, we ran it through once.
Wow.
And recorded.
Wow. That's
and
impressive.
I left the studio. I was so disappointed, because I thought, man, we didn't get Sheila. You know, it was just, I was very unhappy with the record. And then it turned out to be a huge hit, you know, so. It shows what I knew at that young age.
So, two thoughts cross my mind here. One is, are you hard on yourself as a musician and writer songwriter? Are you hard on yourself?
Well, I'm a perfectionist, and
that's hard on yourself.
Yeah, the least little thing will bother me, you know. And I think the only time I left the studio where I was really happy with my recording was when we cut Dizzy.
Really?
When I walked out of the studio with Dizzy, I knew that was a hit record. I felt it in my bones. I loved the way it came off. Everything about it I was just really happy with it. And I think that's the only one. All the rest of them, I was always a little bit, well, we could have done this, and we should have done this. We didn't do this. You know, I'm always nitpicking like that, which is really not too cool.
No, actually, it's what makes you so great. You have your guitar there?
I do, yeah.
Will you sing into my ear, darling?
Well, what do you feel like hearing?
I don't care. Just give me a riff of something. You can do Sheila or do whatever you feel like doing. Just we'll go back to this. But if I can just get you once, who knows? Maybe I'll get you 3 or 4 times during this interview, and then everybody will love me to death because everybody wants to hear Tommy Rowe playing, strumming that guitar of his.
Well, let me see. Maybe I'll do, Sheila. I'll do Sheila.
Okay.
Let me see if I'm in tune. Sweet little Sheila, you'll know her if you see her. Blue eyes and a ponytail. Her cheeks are rosy, she looks a little nosy. Man, this little girl is fine. Never knew a girl like my little Sheila. Her name drives me insane. Sweet little girl, that's my little Sheila. Man, this little girl is fine. Sheila, go for a ride. Oh, 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 I feel it funny inside. Then little Sheila whispers in my ear. Oh, 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 I love you, Sheila, dear. Sheila said she loved me. She said she'd never leave me. True love will never die. We're so doggone happy just being around together. Man, this little girl is fine. This little girl is fine.
So I'm a kid listening to your music on the radio when I'm growing up. Do you realize you just made this girl's dream come true?
Well,
Tommy.
When I first wrote the song, it was called Frida, because I wrote the poem for this little girl I went to school with. It's called Sweet Little Frida. So when I used to sing it with my band, it was like, Sweet Little Frida, you'll know her if you see her.
What happened to Frida? Do you know?
You know, it's funny. I wrote this poem for her. We used to be kind of, I had a crush on her. I'd chase her around the study hall and around the playground, and she'd chase me. We're only like 13 or 14 years old. And so I wrote this poem, you know, Sweet Little Frida, you know, if you see her blue eyes and a ponytail. And so then Dad taught me the chords on the guitar, and I put the music to it. And by the time I got all that accomplished and I was going to present it to her, she'd moved out of the neighborhood. So wherever Frida went, she doesn't have a clue that she started the whole thing. And I've never heard from her. So obviously she doesn't know. And I've talked about it for years. So
wow, that's amazing, either, right?
Who knows? Maybe she moved to Spain or something. I don't know where she went.
Oh, gosh, that's great, though. Listen to me. This is something that struck me about you and doing research for you. This all came on you, as you admit, very early on. It was kind of a quick rise, to say the least. Mm-hmm. There are legendary stories, my friend, about guys like you who amass all this fame, who go off the rails, needless to say, do crazy stuff, some even mm-hmm. implode. It appears that you've got a rather cool head about you, do you?
Well, I tried to go off the rails.
It didn't work.
Dad would kick me in the butt. I mean, my dad was he was tough. He would, if I started getting out of line, he'd let me know about it. But I think I owe all of that to my parents. I mean, I was brought up in a religious household. We went to church every Sunday. I had to put on a little suit and tie. From the time I was 6, 7 years old, I wore a little suit and tie to school, to a church. And so it was just part of the way I was brought up, and my parents were very strict. If I got out of line, I mean, today, you know, my dad would probably be considered an abuser, you know, because that's the way they used to do it in those days. I mean, he'd spank the hell out of me, you know, if I got out of line.
Yeah, it was the times. So, but, you know, here's the thing, because at that time, when you're rising to the top here, your kind of music was like, you know, uh-oh, he's crossing those boundaries, honey. That's not church-going music. How do your folks feel about that?
Yeah, I used to catch a lot of flack for that, too, when I was starting out, because my dad was a big country western. I mean, he loved Hank Williams. He loved all of the Kitty Wells and Ernest Tubb. I mean, he used to watch those, you know, those little 30-minute shows that used to be on TV
sure.
in the 50s.
Uh-huh.
Ernest Tubb. They all had a show, you know. What was the other guy? Oh, there's a bunch of them, but he would watch these shows religiously, and when he taught me the three chords and I started playing blues and rock and roll, he didn't like that at all. He wanted me to be a country singer. You know?
But did they celebrate it when you hit the big time?
Well, they were always supporting me. You know, I tell the story in the book about when Sheila started climbing up the Billboard charts, and Bill Lowry, my producer in Felton, they were trying to get me to, I was working at General Electric, and I had a little girl when I was 19 years old, Cindy, and she's a wonderful girl today, still my little girl as far as I'm concerned. But they were trying to get me to quit my job at GE, and I told them, I said, look, you know, I just landed, it's a great job. I was making about 70, 80 bucks a week, and I was very, like a regular salary, doing my gigs on the weekend, so I was doing okay, trying to support my family, and I wouldn't quit my job. So one day Bill called me at work and he said, Tommy, you got to come over to the office. I got to talk to you about this record. It's moving up the charts like crazy. And so I went by the office after work and he showed me the Billboard chart. And it was like 35 with a bullet, you know, and I didn't really know what a bullet meant. I mean, I was so naive back then. It's really hard to believe. But maybe that was one reason I was successful, because I didn't know too much. You know?
I get that, really. It's true, but, probably.
Yeah, but he said, look, you know, you really ought to consider quitting your job, because you can go on the road. I can put you out on the road. We can promote this record, and I think it's going to be a big hit. I rebuffed him, and I said, well, let me go home and talk about it. He said, well, look, before you leave, let me do this. I'll write you a check in advance against royalties for $5,000. And $5,000 to me at 19 years old was like $100,000 a
sure,
day.
Sure, right.
And so actually it's more than I made in the year, I think. So he wrote me the check, and I went home and talked to my parents about it. And they said, well, look, you know, you're young. If it doesn't work, you can always go back. And I really felt bad, because my cousin had got me this job at GE. And I was really, the thing that I was so worried about was telling him I was quitting my job after about 6 months there, you know. And so I quit the job and went on the road. And one of the first tours I did was with Sam Cooke, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And it was an all black tour, and it went through the South. And that was my first introduction to big time rock and roll, you know.
God, that's just so amazing to me. After Sheila Hits It, did you realize how big you were? Was that going inside your core?
I really didn't. No. I knew all of a sudden I was making money. You know, I mean, I had more money than I ever dreamed of. And I was very fortunate at a young age to hook up with somebody like Bill, because Bill was very straightforward, honest. You know, so many of the guys that my age that got into the business young, they didn't make any money. They end up losing their money for various reasons. But one good thing about with Bill is that we shared the money. You know, he didn't take all the money like most happened to a lot of them.
Right. Yeah.
But no, I really didn't realize. I thought, you know, it's a hit and I've got to follow it up and continue the string of hits. And that's not easy to do. And I managed to, you know, I released a record after that called Susie Darling, which is a remake of Robin Luke's song. And it went to 30 something in the charts. And I thought, well, it's over. That's it. You know, after having a number one, 30 in Billboard is not a big deal, you know.
But, oh, my gosh. Right.
Then things started falling into place when I wrote Everybody. That was another top five record for me. So
that's one of my favorites, too. I love that song. I adore that song. Listen to me. Did you know you made it when you hit it on Green Acres? And I'm probably jumping way ahead. I'm not sure, you know, the timeline thing. But I did see footage of you. I love that.
That was so much fun. I, you know, there was a time, the reason I moved to New York, when I got out of the service, I joined the Army in 1964. I joined the reserves. But the whole year of 1964, I was basically out of the loop. You know, I was in basic training. And so when I got out of the service, I was thinking in the service, you know, what to do, because you had the British acts coming over, pushing the American acts off the Billboard charts. And I thought, man, this is going to be tough to follow up, to compete with all these British guys, the British invasion and Beatlemania and all that, you know. So I started thinking, well, I'll go to New York and I'll study acting. A lot of people said you could be an actor. So I go, that's why I moved to New York, to study acting.
Oh, I didn't know that part. Okay.
And, you know, and then Dick called me to move out to California. I said, well, I can do my acting thing out there too. But one thing led to another, and I ended up in California and ended up doing Green Acres in, I guess it was about 68 or 69.
It's unreal. It is.
But I thought, well, you know, if this is all I'm going to get to do, I'll get to do as an actor, maybe I should reconsider this. You know?
But you looked adorable in that costume that you were wearing. But not only that, what is it? What do you remember them? Do you remember Ava doing? I mean, come on.
Yeah. I was among the stars. Are you kidding me? I love that. I was a big fan of both Eddie Albert and Ava Gabor. And of course, Pat Buttram was on there as well.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I used to watch him when I was a kid in the cowboy movies. So I was in hog heaven, you know. But, you know, that was a fun thing to do. And I remember after that, I did a dinner theater out in Lubbock, Texas. I did Star Spangled Girl.
Oh, really?
And it was like it ran for a month. And I knew after the first week that this acting thing was not a good choice for me.
Good thing for all of us, because back to the music you went.
It's such work.
It is.
I mean, that's why I admire theater actors so much, because I know what they go through. They have to be up for their part every day, matinee sometimes. And I was doing that dinner theater, and I thought, my goodness, this is tough. I can go home and sit in the comfort of my bedroom and write a song. And not have to worry about all this pressure, you know. I better rethink this thing. So that was my last experience as an actor, was when I did the Star Spangled Girl thing.
Well, it's everybody's loss, because you were great in that little clip that I did see of Green Acres. Let's go to 63. You're on tour in Europe with Chris Montez of Call Me and The More I See You fame. You guys are touring a little bit now too together, aren't you? Just for the record.
Oh, we just did the 50th Beatle anniversary. Was it been last year, a couple of years ago now, over in, at the Cavern Club in England. And Chris and I did that as a celebration of that original tour we did with the Beatles.
You are listening to The Hallie-Kesser Jane Show. My guest today is the king of bubblegum pop, Tommy Rowe. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. And we're back, and you are listening to The Hallie-Kesser Jane Show. My guest today is Tommy Rowe. Thanks so much for tuning in.
So anyway, so at 63, you're on tour in Europe with Chris, and your featured band was this relatively unknown band, am I right?
Yes, they were really unknown. I think they did one tour before our tour, which was with Helen Shapiro, I believe it was.
And their name is what?
The Beatles, yeah. And of course, as American artists, we'd never heard of the Beatles, and they were just starting out themselves. Although they, you know, they'd worked the Star Club in Germany and some different places in Europe, but they were just getting their footing as an act, and they had developed this real strong fan base just from their concerts that they had done around, like the Cavern Club in Liverpool and the Star Club in Germany. They were getting enough press to get this following going. So they had their following started. By the time they did our tour, Chris and I, they were on our tour. Well, they had this huge fan base, and they were following them from venue to venue, you know. And it was a real eye-opener. Chris and I kind of got caught up in this Beatlemania thing, and it wasn't very pleasant because it was our tour, but these guys were so popular and they were so powerful on stage, you couldn't follow them. Chris and I both, if you had to follow them, it was just disaster because they created such chaos. And so we changed the order of the show around so we could finish the tour, because the promoter said, look, if we don't fix the show, we're going to cancel the tour, you know. So
they switched you to the front.
Fixed it, yeah. Where the Beatles closed the show, and that's the only way we could do it, because they were just do you remember Hard Day's Night, the movie?
Of course, yeah. Uh-huh.
That was our tour. That's how it was on our tour.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm sure they got all the ideas for that movie from the tour they did with Chris and I.
Wow.
It was just chaotic. I mean, the audience would chase you down the street. They'd climb in the windows to get to you, and it was just amazing. I mean, not only the Beatles, but Chris and I both, we had our fan base as well, and it was the most chaotic thing I'd ever been through.
How did that feel? Was that scary?
It was scary at times, but, we loved it. I mean, we were being, adored for what we love to do. So, of course, it was kind of cool.
Oh, you boys. So tell me a great story. Tell me a story you've never told anybody else. Is there a story like that around you and the Beatles, and maybe that hasn't ever been out there? And if not, just tell us one that's a great story, because that really is amazing. You all were babies. I mean, just babies.
Yeah, we're all 20, 21 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Weird. Did you like them?
The Beatles were such humble. I mean, they were just like us. They were street guys trying to get a break. You know, that's basically, we were all in the same boat. I mean, I had a hit record, and Chris had a hit record, and the Beatles had their first hit record with Please Please Me, or Love Me Do, was their first one over there. So we were basically in the same, you know, in the same position, just trying to get ahead with our careers. And they were great guys. John was kind of my pub buddy. He loved to drink. John was a little rough around the edges in those days, you know. And there was one incident on the bus. They did a release party in Manchester for their album, and we all went to the party. And it was this big house up in Manchester somewhere. A bunch of people there, record executives, and a lot of, you know, local fans and everything. It was a pretty wild party. And Chris and I went back to the bus early. Kind of tired, we thought we'd go back and just catch a nap, because we had to drive that night to our next venue. And so we were on the bus about an hour, and John comes on the bus about an hour later with a pint of Guinness in his hand and walks by Chris and pours the beer over his head. Well, Chris comes out of his seat swinging, you know, and here we are, Chris and John are fighting in the aisles of this bus. Nobody wants to break it up. So I'm the only guy saying, you know, stop it. You know, so I'm the one that breaks the fight up.
Oh, geez.
And it was just one of those crazy instances. I think, you know, we'd been on the tour of probably two weeks by that time. And I think once you're around each other for that much time on a bus traveling around, it gets kind of, you get irritated. But John, like I say, John was always ready for a fight or something. I mean, he's just that kind of guy. But
which did you think was the most talented from your vantage point, seeing them early on when they were really still raw?
Well, John and Paul were the key to the Beatles. I mean, the songwriting team of Lennon and McCartney, is they would be no Beatles without their songs.
But did you see that then? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw it the opening night when we did our tour, when they went on stage. I said, my God, you know, it reminded me of the first time I saw Elvis when I was about 14 years old. You know, I tell the story in the book. You know, I've got a third row seat at the Paramount Theater in Atlanta. I'm going to see Elvis Presley, you know. He's got his brand new record, Heartbreak Hotel, out. And so I'm sitting there waiting for the show to start, and Scotty and the boys come out and they do a few numbers and this polite applause, and they introduce Elvis. He walks on stage and pandemonium breaks out. I mean, I never heard him sing. I hardly got to see him. People were crawling over me to get on stage. Then and there, I said, I want to be a part of this. I like this. You know?
Yeah, really, right?
So this is what I was seeing with the Beatles all over again when I did the tour, only this time I was backstage watching it from the side. And I knew they were going to be a big, but I mean, I don't think anybody realized how big they would be, because they really changed culture. They changed fashion, they changed music styles.
Oh, sure.
But I want to
say something about you that I don't know if anybody else has said, but you know, I know a little bit about music, been around musicians a whole lot. Here's the deal. They could not have become who they became without you, without guys like you, without what happened in America first.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because Brian Epstein and I were talking. Brian wanted to manage me for Europe. We were discussing. Brian didn't have a clue what was going to happen with the Beatles either. He had a stable of artists. And Brian told me, he said, look, the reason I want the Beatles and I want all of my acts to work with guys like you and Chris, because you bring the crowd in. That's how we're going to get our guys seen. And with our connections with you and your management in America, that's how we're going to get to America. So his whole plan from the beginning was to work with American artists and their management to make a relationship to where they could come to America, because no British act had ever made it in America. And, you know, the American record labels were turning them down.
But there's also the sound of your music that came from the sound of, you know, the Buddy Hollies or whomever came before,
right,
that you certainly heard in the early days of the Beatles. That kind of stayed with the Beatles even as they went along, even as crazy out they went. You could still hear those early riffs kind of playing in there. So
they used to do Sheila in their show. You know, they were Big Buddy Holly. They took the name The Beatles because they said crickets are already taken, so we'll be The Beatles. So, I mean, everything that they did, their harmonies, they got from the American artist as well. But, you know, everything they did, they took from the American acts. The American music was huge in England. You know, it's... They used to get their records on the merchant ships. They would bring them back from New York. You couldn't buy American records over there after the war, after the Second World War. And so the merchant ships would come from the States, from New York, and come into Liverpool, and they would buy all their records in America and bring them to England. And that's how they got, you know, the American music, you know, Little Richard and all the big groups from that time, Chuck Berry, they would bring their records over.
Yeah, and it's funny how that changes too, because then it was reversed. Then we started taking stuff from them. I mean, it's really a, you know, it's a give and a take on that whole, the whole music scene. I want to jump ahead. Forgive the pun, but you were in a dizzying time. There's no question about it. All this stuff is, you know, all about you. So you told us a little bit about, you know, went to New York, you can do the acting thing, and then you went to California, and then we get to what, Sweet Pea first?
Mm-hmm. Sweet Pea. That was my, while I was in the Army, I was thinking what kind of music I would record when I got out to compete with the British acts. And so my idea was to write something I call soft rock. And so I wrote Sweet Pea while I was in the service. I started writing it. I finished it when I got out. And so when I went out to California to do Dick Clark's Where the Action Is, I recorded Sweet Pea and with Gary Paxton at his studio there in Hollywood. And so that turned out to be a huge hit for me. And it was the beginning of my new sound, which was a softer sound. I was considered a rockabilly artist before.
Right.
And with Sweet Pea, I started this, the bubblegum thing. So the DJs started calling my music bubblegum music. And so it's a whole new genre for myself. And it, you know, it worked out fine because I was able to compete with all the British sounds and I didn't sound like anybody else, you know, and that was the whole point.
I'm going to go out of context a little bit here because I wanted to go here with you, because there's a theme with you that I find fascinating in a way. Like I said, smart guy, reasoned guy. You know, you seem to have your head on pretty straight. I want to talk a little bit about this cultural change that came with, you know, the Beatles and what have you,
right,
and the British invasion and, you know, in the 60s and yada, 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 yada. Fascinating stuff. And here you are kind of like you got one foot in one world, and I think you've got another foot in another world, which a lot of people got caught in those days. Even if not just musically, just culturally, we all did. We found ourselves kind of, you know, in that kind of thing. So you had enough, you know, Vietnam War thing is starting to bubble up and you know, there's the draft, and probably a lot of people who are listening don't realize that there was a draft
right,
in those days. And you had a lottery number, and you could have found out it was very... So you enlisted in, you mentioned it briefly before, but I want to go into it just a little bit, into the reserves. And you lost a year of your career because you had to go into service, into boot camp for the year, right, whatever it is. And I'm wondering, because that's what you did, how that affected how you were looking at the world and how your music was looking. It's interesting to me at that point, that's when you kind of changed your tune a little bit. Was it because of what you'd seen, or was it because of what you were feeling?
Well, it was because of what was happening. I mean, I saw the Beatlemania thing happening around me. When the Beatles came to America, they did Ed Sullivan, and they did their first concert in Washington, D.C. They invited me to open the show for them in Washington, D.C. That was on February 11th, 1964. And right after that show in the spring, I think it was like March or April, I went into boot camp. You know, so that was my last concert before I went into boot camp. So I saw the writing on the wall. And actually being in the service gave me a little time to think about. They released a couple of records. I did a cover of Chuck Berry's Carol, and they released that while I was in the service. And I think they released one other record. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was. But while I was in the service, it gave me a little time to think about what move I would make when I got out to compete. Because I saw, you know, all like Del Shannon and Bobby V, Fabian, all these acts, they were pushed off the American charts, and the charts were full of British acts.
Right.
So I was thinking, you know, what the hell am I going to do to compete with these guys? So the idea, of course, like I said, was to come up with something new. And my idea was to do the soft rock sound. And so it managed to carry me through the decade of the 60s. And I was able to compete and stay in the charts. I had six top 10 records from 1962 to 1970. And two number ones and a bunch of chart records, you know. So I did, you know, it worked for me. My plan worked. Then towards the end, towards the 70s, you know, music started changing. The disco thing came in, and I made a couple of bad choices, and the record business just ended for me overnight. It was just an amazing thing to see happen. But
Right. But we'll talk about that in a second. I want to stay with Sweet Pea for a second. I had a cat named Sweet Pea, by the way.
Oh, did you?
I did. Out of the style, and we'll get to Dizzy in a minute, but out of the styles, as you evolved and your music, and by the way, is still evolving, but as your music was evolving then, where were you? Did you miss the old days, or were you, oh my gosh, let's go play this. I love being able to go to the next phase. Were you a guy who wanted to keep moving forward with his music, or were you happy just kind of wish you could have just stayed where you were?
No, I was always wanting to go take the next step, go to the next level.
And how did your producers feel about that? I mean,
oh, they loved it. I mean, that's what made it exciting, going to the studio, you know.
Right.
The last album I did for ABC Records was an album called Beginnings, which was probably my best music of the whole time. And it was ironic because the Beginnings album was the end of my chart success. You know, it was like, you know, what did I do to myself here? Beginnings turned out to be the end. But, you know, I was making some great records. I recorded for Monument Records with Fred Foster and Felton. You know, Felton was always there for me when things wasn't going well. And he saw that I was having a hard time in the early 70s. And he did my first album with Monument. It was called the Energy Album. And then after that, Fred took over and did the Full Bloom album and great records. I mean, he made some great records with me. But, you know, they just didn't happen. And,
yeah, when your time is up, your time is up. Welcome to the world, right? Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Listen to me, the Sweet Pea, that I want to go back there because I'm like stuck on Sweet Pea.
You're stuck in the mid-60s, right? Well, that's an exciting time, mid-60s.
I don't know what the problem is, but except to say that there were a lot of covers of that song.
Yes, there were.
And they struck me as odd as to who it was who was covering it. Roger Williams. I don't know if anybody else remembers Roger Williams. My father liked to listen to Roger Williams.
Oh, I love Roger Williams.
So I remember Roger Williams. But Manfred Mann, I think, did a cover of it.
Manfred Mann did a great version and did quite well in Europe. And Roger's version, I kind of did a combination of Roger's tune and Manfred Mann's, which I put on my website for a while. I mean, they're both instrumentals. And totally different kind of takes on the song, but it just shows what you can do with a song. I mean, Roger Williams' piece sounded like a little symphony kind of thing, you know.
Is that around? I didn't find it.
It's hard to find, and I finally got one. I have a copy of it. But to find the record itself, I haven't been able to find the record.
Yeah, that's just so totally cool. I mean, you know, the guy was a genius. You have to give it to him.
Oh, he was great.
You
know, super
and that must have been very flattering to you to have him pick your song, that song. I mean, really.
Yeah. Yes? It was fantastic. I mean, when I heard what he did with it, I thought, my goodness, this is fabulous. And the Ventures recorded it. And Sweet Pea, interesting thing about the acts today, the hip hop acts, and they sample records.
Yeah.
Sweet Pea and Dizzy are two of the most sampled records in hip hop.
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the drums, because all of my those two records, the drums are by themselves, you know, so they can sample that drum thing. They can slow it down or speed it up. It won't sound like it originally sounded, but they get that riff, you know, that beat. And it's in a lot of hip hop records. And, you know, when they first started sampling, we didn't get paid for that. And later on, they changed the law about it. And so now samples, we get paid just like a songwriter, you know. So
you're getting rich, buddy, and that living up there in the Beverly Hills.
Yeah. You know.
God bless, right? No, you know, who cares if I don't have a number one hit? I'm just getting paid. This is good stuff. I like it.
I got to send my kids to school, you know.
Yeah, I mean, these are important.
Listen, I got 4 grandkids and 3 great-grandkids.
Oh, get out of here. Get out of here. I'm telling you, don't tell me that. I look at your face and I just go, are you kidding me? Oh, my God, I hate you.
Well, like I said, my daughter was born when I was 19. So
there you go. You were a child, Daddy. That was the reason. All right, let's get to Dizzy. Is there a song more played than Dizzy?
Well, Dizzy was just a huge record. And like I said earlier, I knew when I left the studio, I just knew it was going to be a hit. It turned out to be my biggest hit. And it was the first hit that I wrote with Freddie Weller, my old friend from Atlanta. Freddie was working with Billy Joe Royal at the time as his guitarist. And Paul Revere had lost his guitar player. And he was asking me if I knew somebody to audition for the job. So I suggested he get in touch with Freddie. So he called Freddie, and Freddie flew out to California and auditioned and got the gig. Next thing I knew, Freddie and I were on tour together with Paul Revere and the Raiders, you know, and with the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars. And so Freddie is just perfect for us because we were old buddies and both songwriters. We started writing songs together. And so Dizzy was one of the first things we wrote. It's a song that I actually dreamed. I dreamed the song. I used to do that a lot with my songs. I used to keep a tape recorder next to the bed. I'd get up in the middle of the night and hum it, you know, because I would forget it if I didn't. And so I took this thing that I dreamed. I said, look, Freddie, I dreamed this song the other night. He laughed. I said, well, I dream a lot of crazy things. So I started singing Dizzy for him, and he really liked it. And we started working on it and finished it on one of the tours. And so that was a good thing for both of us. You know, when he joined the Raiders, we could write songs together.
Oh, that's so amazing. Let's get back to this. So the Starlight leaves, because it leaves everybody. You know, what goes up must come down. I always say that to everybody.
Right.
What did you learn about yourself once the Starlight drifted away?
It was kind of a tough period for me. I was going through a lot of changes personally as well, going through a divorce, and everything seemed to happen at once, you know. And it's probably best that it happened that way, because I got through it rather quickly. It took me about, you know, from 72 to 75 or 76 to really get back on my feet. And Felton was a huge help for me during that period. You know, a lot of people may not know this, but Felton lost the use of his kidneys about around 74 or 75, I think it was. And he was on dialysis for a long time. And so when I would visit him in Nashville, first time I went, he was going to the hospital to do his dialysis. And I came back the second time, and Elvis had gotten a dialysis machine for him in his house.
Wow.
Now that shows you how generous Elvis was. And the doctors taught Mary how to do the dialysis, you know. I don't know if he bought it or if he leased it or how he got it, but Felton didn't have to go to the hospital anymore to do his dialysis sometimes three times a week. He could do it right there at home. Well, I was staying with him during that period while I was going through my divorce, and he was just, as sick as he was an inspiration to me. I mean, he was that kind of guy. He said, look, T, we're going to take you back in the studio. We'll get you going again. And that's how it all happened for me to come back with the Monument stuff. You know, even though they weren't big hits on Monument, they're all really good records, and it was a good time for me.
Everything you do is great, and you just seem to get better. I was going in to see some of the newer stuff, you know, that I wasn't even aware of, and I'm like, what? I mean,
Well, I still enjoy writing songs, you know.
And you're seasoned. Seasoning helps, I think, too. There's nothing wrong with it, you know. Ask me.
Here's a song that I wrote for my wife, Josette, and it's I call it a wedding song. It's called "It's for You, I'm Me." I'll sing a little bit of it.
Go, yeah.
I want to show you I love you. So I buy this diamond ring. When you see it, you go crazy. Such a simple thing. Don't want to make you so happy. Isn't just a fantasy. With love, anything is possible. It's for you, I'm me. Sometimes we cry, sometimes we hurt, and then sometimes life is like dessert. It's like the stars up in the sky. We see them there, but we don't know why. There's a reason we're together. It's how God wanted it to be. I'll be your rock forever, 'cause it's for you, I'm me. I'll be your rock forever, through stormy weather, always together. 'Cause it's for you, I'm me.
That's a lucky lady. That's a very lucky lady. Back to your roots. It's the country thing. It's country. It's your daddy. Well,
that's my daddy. You're right.
How fascinating.
I do a lot of country. I've recorded some country things. I think the DJs, the country DJs, still think of me as a bubblegum guy, you know?
Yeah, crazy. Great stuff. Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. You got to get a wad in there, buddy.
Yeah, that's that bubblegum guy. He's not country. He's bubblegum.
You got to get out of Beverly Hills, and you got to get to Nashville if you really want them to love you and move in there, right? I mean, isn't that the way that game goes?
You're probably right about that. Absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I mean, they never take outsiders. They only want insiders. But, God, that's good stuff. That's just great stuff. So two more questions, really. One is this. One is about your favorite song, your favorite, whether it's something you've written in terms of lyric or in terms of whatever. I know musicians hate that. Here's why I think it's a great question, because whenever people know that I'm going to have somebody on the show, they say, ask them what their favorite song is. So it's a question that you hate, but I'm curious because I know that's what my listeners want to know.
Yeah, it's a tough one to answer, really. If you're talking about my songs, it's the song I wrote called "It's Now Winter's Day" is probably my favorite song of all of the songs I've written. And it's one that's, it was kind of a marginal hit. I just got into the 20s, I think, in the charts. But musically and chord wise, you know, the song is just really kind of a cool song, I think. And I originally wrote it was called "It's Now Christmas Day." And the record label didn't want to pigeonhole it as a Christmas song. And they wanted me to change the title to "It's Now Winter's Day," which was probably a good idea. I don't know. I just re-recorded it as I originally wrote it. And it's on my website. You know, it's called "It's Now Christmas Day." And I've got both of them up there. It's Now Winter's Day and It's Now Christmas Day.
Why is that your favorite?
It's just, I just love the chords in it.
Yeah, you know? I like the chords in that too, because you do, I'm not a musician, but what is it, flat? You go, I love the way you went in that song.
Major seventh, and it goes, it's like, everyone is warm inside their houses in the snow. The mercury is dropping down to minus 10 below. Outside it's chilling, but inside it's thrilling, with fireplaces burning and records that keep turning. It just keeps modulating.
Yeah, I love that. Though, but I, oh my God, I listened to that and I listened to it like 10 times this morning. I was going crazy from that song. Yeah. Just great. But out of the songs that, you know, you fans expect a certain kind of sound from Tommy Roe. But out of all the songs that you've written, which is the one, now this is a different question than the original one that I asked you. So stay
with me.
You're
going to get to answer that one way or the other, right?
Which is the one that's the closest to your heart?
Oh, boy.
That's a woman question. That is such a female question. That's like, shut up, lady. I don't want to. What are you asking me that for?
Yeah, it is a tough question for a songwriter, especially one that I've written so many songs.
I know. But I mean, I write and I photograph and I got a gazillion, but I know that there's one that I always go back to it, and I know why. You know, I know where I was when I took it, what was it's the first thing that comes to my little head when somebody asks me about that. You have one of those?
Thinking about it, I think I can probably give you an answer for that. I tell you why I say this too, because this is one song that every time I do it in my show, a big smile comes on the face of my audience. And this one stands out in that respect more than any of the others. And it's Sweet Pea. I mean, Sweet Pea is such a sweet song. You do it. The young kids love it. The older people love it. The people in their 40s love it. They just smile when you sing it. And that's really cool, you know, to have that happen with something you've created. So I guess in that respect, that's my go-to song in the show when I'm maybe getting kind of bogged down in something, you know, I'll go to Sweet Pea and boom, there you are.
You know what why I think that I understand why that is? I mean, just from my point of view, it is so clean. It is so what it is.
Yeah, it's just a simple, lyrically simple, sweet. It's a sweet song. I mean, that's what it is. And I've had so many fans when I do autographs after my show, which we always do that. And they come up and say, I've called my child Sweet Pea. I used to sing Sweet Pea to my baby when he was like four or five years old. I mean, I've had so many stories about that song and really nice, like you say, clean stories, nice, all-American, wholesome kind of things, you know, which is really good.
So hopes for the future. I'm a very positive person. I don't like that any regret questions. I hate those questions. But I do have hope questions.
I don't really have any regrets. I'm a fatalist when it comes to things like that. I think things happen for reasons.
Right.
And I roll with that. I don't try to change it.
That's why you're still around.
Yeah. I mean, when things happen to me, I deal with it. And I don't have any regrets about anything. I really don't.
So what about going forward?
I'm just moving forward a little bit slower, you know. But I'm still moving forward.
I don't buy it one bit.
Yeah, I'm not barnstorming like I used to, but I'm doing the dates I want to do. And I'm doing it with my band, who I've worked with for like 15 or 20 years. And we have a good time. And I'm doing a few things. I'm promoting the book, of course. I'm doing a few things like that. And so I'm still having fun performing. I'm just picking and choosing what I do and trying to have fun with it as long as I can.
A man who's earned it. Do me a favor, play us out a little bit with Sweet Pea.
Sweet Pea, okay. The song that brings a smile to the face of my audience. I'll use the pick on this one. I hear it. Dance with me. Come on, come on, come on and dance with me. Oh, Sweet Pea, won't you be my girl? Won't you, won't you, won't you be my girl? I went to a dance just the other night. I saw a girl there, she was out of sight. Ask a friend of mine who she could be. He said that her friends just call her Sweet Pea. Oh, Sweet Pea, come on, dance with me. Come on, come on, come on and dance with me. Oh, Sweet Pea, won't you be my girl? Won't you, won't you, won't you be my girl? Won't you, won't you, won't you be my girl? kind of ragged, but
Tommy, you were the best. Thank you. What a cruel thing to do to some musician. Hey, just play. You're a love. I've been speaking with singer-songwriter Tommy Rowe, author of From Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and Places in Between, available at Amazon.com. If you would like an autographed copy of Mr. Rowe's book, A Great Christmas Gift, visit his website at TommyRowe.com, where you'll also find more about the extraordinary talent and career of Mr. Rowe, and when he'll be coming to a city near you with his An Evening with Tommy Rowe. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.